Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
We'll be in 1 Samuel chapter 21 this evening, and just as we normally do, just with a recap from how did we get to 1 Samuel 21? Well, chapter 15, Saul is rejected as king. Samuel is left there with the corner of his robe in his hand. This is what has happened. Saul is holding Samuel's corner of the robe in his hand. And then chapter 16 comes and David is anointed. The Lord rushes upon David. The Spirit of the Lord leaves Samuel, Saul. And then finally, the sign of that anointing is evident in chapter 16, but really in chapter 17 when David defeats Goliath. Chapter 18, they come back, and Saul is envious of David, but everybody loves, Saul is envious of David, but everyone else loves David. And then chapter 19, Saul tries to kill David, sends men to his house. We looked at Psalm 59, and then last week we looked at chapter 20, where finally Jonathan also got to see this side of Saul. So there's two people in the kingdom that we know of that have seen this evil, sinful side of Saul. But now we start, and David is a fugitive. He is running for his life at the end of last chapter of 20. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever.' And he rose and he departed, and Jonathan went into the city." However, we come now to chapter 21, and we've seen David really in a positive light. But we've noted a couple of times where David has acted somewhat sinfully, not necessarily sinfully against Saul. That's always what comes up. What have I done against you? But I think we start to see glimpses of David as a sinful man. We know he is a sinner. We know this from Psalm 51, that in the womb I was conceived in sin. And we know that he needs a Savior. He is not the Savior himself. However, I think chapter 21, I think, shows and displays a little bit more of his human nature in his sinfulness that comes out. And really, there's two parts in this chapter that are based on location. And you see a huge difference from chapter 17, where David is standing there before Goliath in chapter 21. And then even again, you noticed a little bit last when we looked at chapter 20, we saw these glimpses of fear in David. He wasn't as bold as he once was. And in chapter 20, 13 times in the chapter, the Lord is mentioned. And about three times by David, but mainly by Jonathan himself. So he's not his normal self, you might say, but only twice in chapter 21, and never by David in verses 6 and 7, when the words "before the Lord" appear. So just a slight thing, I think, in this chapter, we do see David as a sinner, not the sin of Bathsheba, not as horrendous as that, but I do think we see these sins. Now, he goes to the priest to inquire of the Lord. We know this from chapter 22, verses 9 and 10. And Doeg, the Edomite, who stood before the servants of Saul, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord, and he gave provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine." So David comes, he flees from Saul. Previously, he went to Samuel as a godly man. In 1 Samuel 19, he fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah, and he told him all that Saul had done to him. But in this chapter, he flees again, and he goes to a priest of the Lord, a similar thing. But we see in chapter 19, verse 18, that he tells Samuel what Saul had done to him, whereas we don't see that in this chapter. And I just want to point that out before we get into this. But David now comes to Nob, which we got to remember that Gilboa is the capital of Jerusalem. Gilboa is where Saul is from. This is where their home base is set. It kind of moves with the leaders, with the judges. So Gilboa is here in the middle flag on the right-hand side. And they go to Ramah, running away from Saul. They go to Samuel, to Ramah. That's where Samuel is located. And then they come back down and they end up in Nob. So his intentions, I think, when he's coming to Nob are good. He's going to seek sanctuary underneath God's people. So Gilboa, Ramah, see, and then back to, and then he goes to Nob. So chapter 22, again, it says that he inquired of the Lord in verse 10 and gave provisions of him. In the same chapter 15, first time the priest explains that he comes to Ahimelech. When he goes there, Ahimelech is trembling, he's shaking. Why are you alone and no one come to you? Now, this isn't a common occurrence. We find in the next chapter, 22:15. It's not the first time that David has come to Ahimelech to be able to inquire of the Lord. It's a common occurrence. So again, this godly man goes to Ahimelech to be able to find this, to speak to the priest. So the first thing we're going to look at today is an unholy man in a holy place, an unholy man in a holy place. And we see this in the first 9 verses. Then David came to Nob and Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech came and met David trembling. And he said, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" And David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, 'Let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here.' And the priest answered David, 'I have no common bread on hand, and there is holy bread. If the young men have kept themselves from women,' and David answered the priest, 'Truly women have been kept from us as always when we go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is on an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy?' So the priest gave him the holy bread, and there was no bread there but the bread of presence, which was removed from before the Lord to be replaced by the hot bread on the day it was taken away. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief priest of Saul's herdsmen. And then David said to Ahimelech, 'There have you not here a spear or a sword at hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste.' And the priest said, 'The sword of Goliath and the Philistine, whom you have struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here, wrapped in the cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none but that here.' And David said, 'There is none like that. Give it to me.'" I want to be able to show that where David is a holy place, but also his actions during this place are somewhat unholy. First, David is located in a holy place. That the first thing we see repeated throughout this time is the comment or the word priest coming up. Now, David goes to Nob to meet the priest. He comes and meets Ahimelech the priest. And Samuel wants to explain, as he's writing this, the holiness of the place that David has come to. He comes to Ahimelech the priest and continually comes up in the passage. He's more referred to as the priest than Ahimelech. The priest was serving, but they had heard from chapter 14. We haven't really heard anything about the priest serving. In chapter 14, verses 2 and 3, when Jonathan goes in to defeat the garrison of the Philistines, Saul was saying, on the outskirts of Gilboa in the cave at Migron, and they came where the people of 600 men, including Abijah, the son of Atiab, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. So Abijah is an Amalek, or brothers. They share the same father. And Samuel does not, in this passage, connect Amalek to Eli that he does in chapter 14. Saul's there and Saul's relying on Abijah in chapter 14. But when this name comes up here in chapter 21, Samuel doesn't make that connection, although we know it's there. And I think I would say that Amalek is a godly man. He's a man that David has come to on several occasions, as we know in the next chapter. He's come to be able to seek the Lord. So here you have Amalek here, again, even serving, trusting David. You know, it's not always easy to have good guys and bad guys, but I think sometimes you can see those connections, who hangs out with who. And in this case, David hangs out with Amalek. So I think there's a couple of points where I think that we see that this Amalek is not so much in the line of Eli as Abijah might have been, but David goes to him. We see this in like he did with Samuel. He turns to a godly man. His concern is with God and his holiness. The thing that comes up with a lot of what was Eli's son's problem was that they were dealing with things and not doing what God had required, not keeping things holy, set apart. What was the thing issue with Samuel's sons? It was that they were unjust judges. And Eli's sons were unholy priests. But here, Amalek wants to make sure that his men are being kept holy. His concern is the holiness of God and the men's holiness. And he questions about the men's keeping themselves from women. And he also has Doeg, the Edomite, a servant of Saul, detained. Now, we don't have the church-state distinction that we do. We don't have prisoners in our basement at this church. But here, the church-state is a little bit more intertwined. So here he has Doeg, the Edomite, who's detained. So you would assume that he's doing so for a godly reason. Like we see in Acts, the high priests and the whole council of elders bear witness that when they go to Damascus and they bring them to the bonds to Jerusalem to be punished. Here in Acts, you have the high priest detaining Paul. And so too, it's in this case that you might have a priest detaining someone because they're not upholding the law or, doing what they're meant to do. So I think Amalek is a godly man, and this is why David comes to him. And David approaches Amalek, and Amalek is trembling, maybe concerned about what is David going to do for punishing Doeg. Maybe he's trying to uphold the law, and then in comes David, second in command almost with Saul, or very high up, and Saul has sent him to get his herdsman back, Doeg. But he just comes, and David and Amalek comes and asks him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" Now, his response it's the same example when Samuel comes to the city of David in Bethlehem, and the elders come to meet Samuel, and they come out trembling, asking them, "Why do you come peaceably?" So again, I think you see a similar thing here, that David is coming up and Amalek is concerned about why he is here. Why are you alone? Why is no one with you? Again, this is a common occurrence, and this is out of character, it seems. And he had come previously. Maybe he'd come with lots of people before, but now he's there alone, no one with him. Now, when Jesus explains his situation in Matthew chapter 12, he explains that when David was hungry and those who were with him. So maybe he has a small entourage with him. He doesn't have a large army as he normally does. But here, maybe it is true that they're waiting outside to see what would happen if it's safe, if Amalek is on Saul's side or on David's side. We don't know exactly. It's hard to know, as I said, who are the good guys and bad guys in children's movies. It's easy to be able to see, but as time progresses, as you grow older, you realize that the line is not always as clear. When you play basketball or a team sport, you know who's on whose side because you wear colored jerseys. They don't walk around here. The battle is within. No one walks around going, Team Saul on their shirt, Team David on their shirt. But David is a fugitive. He's running around. He's not sure who's Saul has commanded to be able to kill him, as he did at the start of chapter 19. So, again, even Jonathan didn't know who his father really was. So he goes to this holy place and he speaks to this holy man. And holy is used three times in this passage, and it's not used any other time in 1 or 2 Samuel. This is the only three times the word holy is used in 1 and 2 Samuel. It's also not used in the book of Judges and the book of Ruth. And if you believe, I tend to believe that all those four books, or especially Judges, Ruth, and 1 Samuel, up to Samuel's death, are written by Samuel himself. So this is a very important thing that Samuel wants to point out, or the author wants to point out, whoever it is. He wants to point out that this is a very holy place. And he's speaking to a holy man, a priest, and he comes and he's going to get served holy bread. They have no common there bread, only holy bread. Now, again, we look back to 1 Samuel chapter 2 with Hannah's prayer. Hannah's prayer in verse 5, 2 verse 5. Says that in 2 verse 5, those who are full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who are hungry have ceased to hunger. And the Lord's rejection of here, there's no bread in the house besides the people that are the holy bread. Now, this is a fulfillment of this prayer. Those who have fooled have hired themselves out for bread, but those who are hungry have ceased to hunger. Now, the priest would be able to eat the holy bread, but if you weren't serving as a priest at the time, you wouldn't be able to eat that holy bread. This is what the point is in Matthew. Here's his disciples picking grain on the Sabbath, and it says, well, let's look at David. David wasn't a priest, but yet he ate this holy bread. So it's only good if you would hunger if you're not, you're going to hire yourself out in Samuel, or that the Lord's rejection of Eli's house. Now remember, Ahimelech is also Eli's descendant, and they say, 2:36, everyone who is left in your household shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread, and shall say, please put me in one of the priest places that I might eat a morsel of bread. So here we see the fulfillment of this promise in chapter 2, verse 36. Now, actually, they have no bread in their cabinets. The only bread they have is this holy bread. So there's 12 loaves normally set apart, arranged on two stacks of six on the table of showbread, and they're replaced weekly on the Sabbath. And the table of showbread was located in the holy place on the tabernacle near the presence of Yahweh's presence. And the bread really symbolized one aspect of the covenant relationship which shared between Israel and Yahweh. And the bread before, the bread of presence it's called, is actually a better translation, like bread of face-to-face. It shows the intimacy between God and his people. So this bread before the Lord in verse 6, so the priest gave him the holy bread, for there is no bread but the bread of presence, which was removed before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. So we have this holy place. He goes to this holy place to speak to a holy man, and he's get holy bread. And again, His concern is about holiness. The priest is concerned about the holiness of those eating the bread. That in verse 4, it's not, I don't have any common bread, but there's holy bread. Have the young men kept themselves from women? And David even understands this question of holiness that they have. We normally do when we go on an expedition. And even now, even more so, they have been kept holy. So now they're in a holy place before the Lord, and the priest eventually gives him the holy bread, because there was no bread but the bread of presence, which was removed from before the Lord. And there was a servant of Saul that was detained that day. And we also see the ephod. Again, this ephod comes up again and again. When Samuel's serving in the temple, his mom Hannah would come and each year and make a new ephod for him to be able to wear in the temple. This holy garment, and this is where the sword of Goliath is in verse 9. And the priest said, "The sword of Goliath, the Philistine, is struck down in the valley of Elah." And he wrapped a cloth behind the ephod and it would take it away and take it. There's none here. So here's the sword of Goliath wrapped in an ephod in a holy place. And all of this was done to be before the Lord. All of these holy things were holy because they were set apart, because they were set apart to be near the Lord. The holy bread is set apart because it's parallel to the Ark of the Covenant. The priest is to set apart because of their position to go in to serve the people of God. All these are set apart for holy use. They're ordinary things, but they're set apart for holy use. And all of this is taking place before the Lord, before the Lord, before the face of the Lord. But however, I want to point out here that we're in a holy place, but David is an unholy man. David's response in this chapter, I don't think, is one of great faith, like we have seen before, but one more that is driven by fear. His actions are fear-driven because of the self-preservation rather than faith of God to protect him. In 1 Samuel 17, we saw him in his weakness go and trust and rely on the Lord to be able to protect him, to turn to God for strength. He knew he had weaknesses. In this chapter, he turns more to his own strengths to be able to preserve him. Maybe he's doubting, you know, as a true believer might sometimes, and not necessarily have all the answers about how God might be able to protect him. You know, Abraham did the same in chapter 12 of Genesis when he goes in before Pharaoh. He's concerned about his own life in that situation. Sarai is my sister. Again, in chapter 22, he does the same thing. He shows moments of weakness. And again, the Bible doesn't paint a picture of perfect people in positive lights, but we are sinners. It's very rare in the Bible to paint a picture of someone who really models a really godly life. You might see maybe Samuel might be a good example of this, and often the prophets are not ones that go into their sinfulness. But we know he's a sinner. Some people have pointed out that he's a sinner in the sense that he didn't really raise his children well. I don't think the text really spells that out clearly, but we need to be aware that David is a sinner, and I think this chapter shows some of that weaknesses creeping in. And he comes, and his response when he comes to Samuel, he goes to Samuel the same manner, and he tells him exactly what Saul has done. In this chapter, though, he comes back, and the first question that he's asked, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" This is a great spot for him to be able to turn around and say, "I'm alone because Saul is trying to kill me. I'm innocent. I haven't done anything wrong. He's tried to pin me against the wall several times with a spear. He's sent me into battles to try and put me to my death. He's encamped around my house with sending people like prowling dogs. He wants me dead, and I need refuge. I need safety. Will you help protect me?" Just like he did with Samuel. When he went to Samuel, he told him all that Saul had done. But he responds with a little bit of fear rather than faith. He responds more with deceit and lies. "The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, 'Let no one know anything in the matter which I send you and which I have charged you.'" Even his location made up, you know, "We're meeting the men at such and such a place." I think he's worried in this time if Ahimelech is on Saul's side. Yet why does he go here? I think there's a little bit of fear in his question. And even when he goes there, he's going there for bread, but also for a weapon. Now, in chapter 17, he stood before Goliath with nothing but his shepherd's equipment. But now he goes and turns to man's strength, man's weapons of Goliath, and he seeks to find his own weapons. That this is kind of his concern. You know, "Do you have any swords or spears on hand?" you know, another reason I'm running. I left haste because I needed to leave my house because Saul's men were coming in to kill me. I needed to go out a window. You know, I fled. I was hiding behind a rock when Jonathan told me to run for my life, and I did. You know, but here he finds himself going on a mission sent by the king, but he's forgotten his sword. So he gets the sword that is Goliath's, and as you remember in 1 Samuel 17, David responds and says to Goliath, "You come at me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come at you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled." He resorts back to his physical strength rather than relying on God. So the priest tells him in verse 9, "The sword of Goliath, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take it, take it. And there is none but that here." And David said, "There is none like it. Give it to me." His response is not to turn to the Lord again. There's an absence of David inquiring and seeking the Lord in this moment. He resorts to the way of man, what Saul would do, what Goliath would do to protect himself. He doesn't trust in God. He really trusts in himself. But ultimately, in this action, we see that he puts Ahimelech and the priests at danger. He comes and explains what is happening. He sees Doeg the Edomite, and he knows there's danger there, but he's concerned more about himself. He's a terrible shepherd, really, at this time. Ahimelech might have known more about it if David was up front and told him about Saul. You know, he answers questions about it in the next chapter, and Ahimelech's just oblivious of what's happening. Might have been able to spare some men with him, but David is concerned about himself. And even in the next chapter, when he's talking to him, David does see that he is responsible when one of the sons of Ahimelech comes to him at the end of chapter 22. And David says to him, "I knew that on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul and have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house." So here he actually realizes he plays a part in what's going to happen in chapter 22. But in all of this, we need to understand that we are all sinners, that God can use this. God shows him grace. He shows him mercy. He was hungry and he fed him. Again, that chapter in chapter 2, when the disciples are there picking off the grain off the head on the Sabbath, have you not read what David did when he was hungry in verse 3? And those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of presence. It was not lawful for him to eat, nor those men that were with him, but only for the priests. And then he says later in that chapter, "If you have known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. You have not condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." When Jesus brings this up, he doesn't bring out that David came in fear. He doesn't bring out David's sin, how David lied. But he shows God's grace, his mercy during this time. As Hosea 6 says, "For I've desired steadfast love and not sacrifice, knowledge rather than burnt offerings. I sought the Lord and he answered me." In verse 34, what a difference it is between Saul and David. Sinless. They're not. David isn't sinless per se, but David has a heart for God. We'll look at this more next week when we look at Psalm 34, when I think David, his response of fear turns and he repents. Like in Psalm 34, "I've sought the Lord and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears." Or in verse 8, "O taste and see, the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him." Or 13, "Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit." So here we have example where David is in this, in the holy place. And I don't think he responds in a faith manner. Now, we don't then point the finger and just say, "Well, David messed up." We point the finger and we look at and see ourselves in this situation, that David is just like a man like us. He has moments of weakness where he doesn't thrive, and so do we do as well. That doesn't then stop him from being a saint. The second thing we see is that he's the unholy man in an unholy place, an unholy man. So after Nob in verse 9, in chapter 10, he rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, to the king of Gath. So David rose, he runs again. I think fear is getting a hold of him. It's not a very wise decision. Now, if you remember where Goliath was from, Goliath was from Gath. So now he thinks that his best option, and I think it might be his best option, I don't really know his other options at this time, but the best option, he thought, was to go to Gath. And he walks into Gath, and in Gath, and what does he have attached to the side of his hip is Goliath's sword. And he goes to this place, and he seeks to maybe think this is a good opportunity for him, I'm not sure. But it doesn't seem like a very smart decision. Maybe this is the best option he has. So he goes to Gath, where Goliath is from, and in verses 11 to 15, and the servants of Achish said to him, "Is this not David the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And David took these words to heart and was much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see, the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought me this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall his fellow come into my house?" So Achish will eventually become an ally in 1 Samuel. But for now, David walks into Gath, trying to blend in. He's there. He's got the sword of Goliath on his side. You know, imagine walking down and walking past Goliath's house or seeing Goliath's grandma or, these times, this sword of the champion of Gath around his waist and goes into a Philistine camp. But also, if you remember, even after what is happening, Gath is where the Philistines are. Now, who has David been fighting all this time? The Philistines. That he's come in, what did he do for Michal to try and get Michal's hand in marriage? He goes and gets 200 foreskins. So now he's in this place where he's got a giant target on his back. Maybe he's foolish or maybe he's hopeless. He thinks this is the best option for his survival. Later in 1 Samuel, he'll go to Gath, and Saul explains that Saul doesn't pursue him when he goes to Gath another time, so maybe he was right a little bit there. But even the servants point out, and they call him the king of the land, that he's obviously done so much that outsiders think he's king, from an outside perspective. It's interesting that Saul doesn't see him as king, that the people of God don't see him king, but the outsiders do. And they've heard that song, that famous song that must be playing on the top 100 playlist or whatever around the time at that time, that Saul had killed there at thousands, but David has killed his hundreds of thousands. But again, when we hear this, we think about this song, but what is it, 100,000, tens of thousands, Philistines. And where is he? He's in a camp of Philistines. So you think about all the 10,000s that he's killed, and surely someone in here has lost a close relative because of what David has done to them. Now David takes these words to heart. Now I'm not sure what this exactly means. Some believe that Psalm 55 is written during this time. When we look at the Psalms going through the book of 1 Samuel and potentially 2 Samuel, I'm just going off what the titles explain. But some believe Psalm 55 is written during this time. And Psalm 55 says, "My heart is anguished within me, and the terrors of death had fallen upon me. Fear and trembling have come upon me, and horror overwhelms me. This is, you know, the heart of anguish has fallen upon him. So here David is in this situation. Maybe people are gathering around him. He's drawn a lot more attention to himself than he thought. But he took it to heart and was much afraid. So this is exactly what happened in the reverse in 1 Samuel 17. When Goliath was before the men, Saul was shaking in his boots. He was afraid and dismayed, greatly afraid. But now David is around the Philistines, and David is the one who is afraid. David wasn't afraid in chapter 17 when he faced their champion, but now in chapter 21, his response is more like Saul than it was than him in chapter 17. And he changed his behavior before them. Proverbs 29:35, "The fear of man lays a snare, but whoever trusts the Lord is safe." Or in 1 Samuel 15:24, Saul said to Samuel, "I have sinned and I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord. For your words, I have feared the people and obeyed their voice." Or Deuteronomy 1:17, "And you shall not be partial in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not be intimidated by anyone, for the judgment is God's. And the case that is too hard for you, you shall bring it to me, and I will hear it." They go for this advice, and advice during this time would be go back to God, take refuge in God. You know, but his plan is a little bit different. His plan is maybe a little bit simpler in verse 13. "So he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gate and let the spittle run down his beard." Now, the Hebrew of this is that he pretended to be, and there's no actual word in there in the Hebrew for the word insane. It just says that he pretended. He lied with his lips previously, but now he's more lying with his actions. He played a fool. Now, we just need to maybe pause and take note that he does have a beard. There's a very uncommon in the Bible to be explained references, and even here it's not a reference of being able to describe his appearance as such. It's just he had spittle, and where did it run? It ran down his beard. But this is he does this, pretends to be insane. He pretends to be something. He knots marks on the doors, have spittle down his beard. But this is one of my favorite responses. You know, this might be a great thing to be able to put up on your wall at your house or something, one of these nice scripture responses that everyone has on their house. "And Achish said to his servants, 'Behold, you see that the man is mad. Why have you brought him to me? Do I lack madmen that you should have brought this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence?'" Do I lack madmen? I've got enough of these madmen in my presence. Why do I need another one? You know, I'm sure you might have this case at home. You know, why do you need another tool? Why do you need another pair of shoes? Why do you need another thing? And his response is, "I don't need any more madmen. I've got enough." So, but his plan does work. Achish does not want him in his presence. He's thought he has lost his mind. But again, I think this is one of these cases where I think that David learns from this. In Psalm 118:9, it is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes. And when we look at David as a mere man who has fear, who is driven, not always doing the right thing, it points forward to Christ. That David is not the Christ. That it's not David, have mercy on it. It's son of David, have mercy on it. That God would descend from his line, David's line, and give him the promise, give David the promise. Now we'll see more of Achish, but amazing that Psalm 34 is written during this incident. Psalm 34, the psalm that I think that most of us would know, "To taste and see the Lord is good." We know things like this, but it was written during this time, the title of Psalm 34, when he changed his behavior before Abimelech. We'll talk about that next week. So he drove him out and he went away. And he's written right about this time. We see a different man. Saul and David are both sinners. They're both not perfect. Yet one does turn to God. One does turn to God while the other just completely ignores him. In Psalm 34, I will bless the Lord at all times. Praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes it boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name forever together. In the end, the Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. So here, he doesn't run to God as he does in other passages. He doesn't lean on God as he does in other passages. And I think this is one of these times where we see a slight, again, not a complete blunder, not a complete fall from David. But he doesn't necessarily act exactly how he does in chapter 17. There's a little bit of a twist, and I think that's a good comfort for us as we think and consider that how we might act in sinful manners or more driven by fear than faith. That David, too, was a man that needed to turn and take refuge in the Lord, that he did, and it drove him closer to God, that he was able to bless the Lord at all times, to praise him continually with my mouth.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.